I need to not take my pint of water onto my laptop there.
Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Elliot Morgan.
Hello.
And we're going to focus our attention on how we can make learning more challenging. But first, Elliot, what's you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
I'm sort of in between books at the moment because I've just finished a book and then I've sort of been dipping back into books. But I guess the most recent book that I read was Sarah Cottingham's Meaningful Learning in Action. I don't know if you can see that, a bit blurry in the Zoom. I'm going to butcher his name. Is it Ashabel? I've heard many different pronunciations of it. But yeah, great book, short, digestible, concise, straight to the point. One of those sort of education books that's like no nonsense, no faff. Yeah, it really does get straight to the point. And sort of an interesting deep dive into Ashabel's work around sort of meaningful learning, the idea that like prior knowledge is perhaps the most important factor when it comes to teaching information, and the idea that meaning is where sort of relevant existing knowledge meets new information being taught. I highly recommend reading it. Sarah's a great writer. I think I said Cottingham, that was her name before. Her name's now Cotting Hat. But you can find her on Twitter. Overpracticed, I think, is her handle. I forget what her blog is called, but I'm sure you can find it through Twitter. And she's got loads of great blogs. And in fact, there was also a Tadape app, wasn't there? Where she talked to, I think Chris was on it a while ago. So go and give that a listen as well. What are you reading for, Kieran?
Yeah, absolutely right. Sarah was on a while ago. I mean, need to try and see if we can get her back on again because I know she's working on a book on coaching, I think.
Right,
and so nice. Obviously very interested to see what she thinks about that. I've been reading a paper called Explicit and Implicit Pedagogy, Variation Theory as a Case Study. It's from, I think, 2011-ish. John Mason explores the tension between sort of those explicit and those implicit approaches in teaching and uses variation theory as almost like the case study for the analysis. No one give away the ending for anyone who does decide to read it, but it's as always a really enjoyable and accessible read from John, so check it out if you can. So Elliot, we're going to explore how we can make learning more challenging for our pupils. Many people might be going, oh my goodness, that's not what we want to do. But I think that's the whole point of the conversation and the whole point of your talk that you've been doing at Research Ed, which I hear went down really, really well. I think it makes sense to start with, how would you define challenge?
So I'm gonna be cheeky here, and I'm gonna start by flipping that question onto you, because that's what I did at the start of the talk. And the reason being because I think it's so elusive, so hard to pin down. But Kieran, how would you define challenge in learning?
Right. So having had no time to prepare a response to this,
I have put him on the spot, listeners. He had no idea.
I think challenge is a description of the amount of effort needed to required to complete a task. And so in learning, challenge is the amount of effort needed to successfully, at least initially, learn something, in inverted commas, because we know that learning as a process takes place over time, but that initial connection to other things, you know, like you said, that prior knowledge, that initial process, how difficult that is, how much effort you need to put in, I think is probably the best way to consider challenge, in as much as the amount of weight that someone lifts in the gym will be relative to their starting point and what they can do already. Same for learning. Well, how did I do?
No, it looked good, that, especially that last point. No, a fairly well-rounded definition there. And anybody listening who thinks I'm going to be able to give them like a spot-on perfect definition, I'm afraid that that's not the sort of conclusion I came to in my reading. But my definition is sort of multifaceted. And I guess the reason I sort of went down this route of reading around challenging learning in the first place is that, and well, in fact, I was talking to you about it the other day, that like when I was an NQT, my mentor would say to me, like, look at my lesson plan and go, okay, great, but how are you going to push the hires and like the higher priority attainers? That was a phrase I heard a lot. And I never really knew, because I was a novice, how do I push those children? How do I challenge them further? So the first part of the talk I gave at Research Ed was sort of trying to pin down this definition of what challenge is. And I guess if I were to try and define it in a single sentence, I'd perhaps say it's something along the lines of like when prior knowledge meets an unfamiliar context. So that idea that there isn't sort of this prior experience we can fall back on and rely upon, and that the learner sort of has to engage in thinking deeply and thinking hard. And then sort of thinking deeply or thinking hard obviously ties to cognitive load, doesn't it? So cognitive load from a task perspective, Reif's equation, I think it's Reif's, R-E-I-F, equation around cognitive load, the idea that it equals sort of task demands over available resources. So resources being sort of the mental resources, such as working memory capacity, prior knowledge, and so on. But it could also be sort of physical resources available to you. If we take that equation, it's useful because it defines cognitive load as sort of this this quantity that's like this relationship between task demands and those available resources. And I quite like to think of it as like this balance, like a seesaw between sort of task demands on one side and available resources on the other. And if it tips too much in the favor of one or the other, then you could either have like sort of cognitive overload, or perhaps we're not optimizing cognitive load as we like. So if the task is too demanding, then it perhaps leads to cognitive overload. Whereas if the task is quite easy and the pupil has a sort of a surplus of available resources, be that prerequisite knowledge or otherwise, then it's not challenging enough for them, and it'd be, we're not optimizing that load. So sort of visualizing that as sort of like a seesaw, and you and I have discussed in the past about perhaps we want that to sort of tip slightly in the favor of task demand. So we're pushing the learner out of their comfort zone, and sort of trying to get them to try and access a task that's kind of just out of reach. And then obviously, speaking of the learner, as you did in your definition, they obviously play a significant role in establishing what is and what isn't challenging. And you've got a good example in your book, actually. You've got a chapter on depth and challenge. And I gave a sort of similar example in my talk. But yours is something, just remind me, yours is something along the lines of like, if a pupil is very confident with place value up to say 10,000, and then you just give them place value up to like 100,000, that's not necessarily likely to challenge them. It's something along those lines. You just refresh my memory.
But I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah, because I sort of outlined the premise that challenge is relative. And as a new teacher, we need to think about what might be challenging. I mean, obviously, you've got the classic trope where we give larger numbers, and we expect that to be a challenge when actually it's not really, because I think your understanding of large numbers is very much based on our experience of, I mean, like I think sort of evolutionary psychologists think, you know, the amount of time you've lived, it's roughly the amount of time you can imagine. And so in my mind, you know, when we're trying to show, you know, the difference between 100 and 1,000 and tens of thousands, you get diminishing returns in terms of actual, you know, how much do I really understand this? You could look at a big crowd of people and you might just pull a number out of the air, and, you know, the greater that number, the more, you know, the less accurate it's going to be, but it's not actually making it more challenging. You know, you get people like Johnny Hall and Atul Rana, who talk about how they work with multi-base with their students. And so Atul will do multi-base with reasonably young pupils. And, you know, I had this conversation with one of my kids the other day. I was saying to them, right, so you've got place value. What about if, what would the number 40 look like in BS6? So this is as we're walking into school, and he's yet to come back with an answer, but we were talking through what might happen. And he made them, I didn't tell him, but he made the mistake where he thought that 6 would be the last digit, but actually the next one becomes a 1 once you get to, once you get past 5. And so that is how you challenge pupils. And I think there are severely diminished returns with this larger number game that we play, but it's so prevalent across many, many classrooms, probably because we're not sure ourselves what that depth looks like. And certainly the further into mathematics you go, the more sort of difficult it is to find others who have explored in insufficient depth, I think. And so it's almost like I'm starting to conflate depth with challenge, but we need to go deeper into the mathematical sort of structures and the mathematical ideas to increase the challenge for pupils. I think that is probably what I was talking about, but I may have done that at different points in the book.
Yeah, so well, listeners, it's available in all good bookshops. So go and grab a copy if you haven't already. But yeah, so the example I gave, and this is just something that I know that I would have done as a novice. And I talked about how if I've got pupils adding 5-digit numbers together as a challenge or sort of form of extension, I go, okay, here's 6-digit numbers, and I want to add them. But conceptually, doesn't really challenge their thinking at all. The idea, like if you know how to add 5-digit numbers in through column addition, you can probably go for as many numbers as you want because nothing's changing really. Nothing's making them think more deeply. But as you say, challenges relative to the content, so and the learner. So in that instance, getting them to just add 6-digit numbers, getting them to do more isn't more challenging. Whereas if it was say something like PE, and like people's quite tired, and then we go, right, we want to, you're going to now run more laps. Well, that would be more challenging, wouldn't it? Because that it's now it's just sort of trying to demand more from them. So in that sense, challenge is relative to both the content being taught and to the learner sort of engaging with that content. In addition to that, in the talk, I mentioned about the idea that I guess this isn't quite defining challenge, but a way of viewing challenge is that we can view it as sort of this form of progression in learning. The idea that it's challenging to use knowledge in a sort of an unfamiliar context. That helps knowledge become more flexible over time. And so through the use of sort of like challenging tasks, knowledge can transition from being very shallow, inflexible, unique to the sort of the original context in which it's learned, towards this sort of more deeper, more flexible knowledge over or throughout a course of learning by getting people to engage within challenging tasks. And then I guess that the final point I made, I got on my soapbox a bit, and I talked about sort of high participation strategies. So strategies where you're getting all pupils to think and engage. And the point I was making is that things like that, and I'm not going to name any specific strategies, but like I'm sure listeners will know many. The idea behind those sort of strategies, they shouldn't be seen as a form of challenge. Getting all pupils to participate is sort of a, should be seen as the minimum expectation in the classroom. We have this moral obligation to create an intellectually stimulating, inclusive environment, and getting all pupils to think as much as possible is a key driver of that. So I'll get back off my soapbox now. But so in that sense, I was talking about like what challenge is and what challenge isn't. And I was saying like getting all pupils involved shouldn't be seen as like a challenging task. It should be seen as sort of the norm, because we want all pupils to progress, all pupils to be challenged in their thinking.
So your talk then moved on to conditions surrounding learning. Can you tell us some more about that?
I looked at sort of preconditions that we sort of need in place before challenge can occur. And then I also looked at sort of conditions that arise as a result of implementing challenging tasks. But I began that sort of section. I showed this teacher tap poll. And the question was, well, it was a statement, and teachers had to say whether they agreed or not. And the statement was, I deliberately include hard material in my lessons. So, Kieran, what percentage roughly do you think either agreed or like strongly agreed with that statement that I deliberately include hard material in my lessons?
Ooh, that's interesting. I mean, there must be some sort of bias where I'm thinking, trying to work out what the shock from the answer is. I reckon 70% of teachers would say they tried to include.
A strong guess, very strong guess. So 75% either agreed or strongly agreed. It's a very good guess there. So it doesn't seem as teachers that we have an issue with including hard content or deliberately including hard, challenging content, but there are many issues that we face when we implement challenges. So cast your mind back to when you're teaching maths, let's say, in a classroom. What sort of issues arose for you when you tried to implement challenging maths work in the classroom?
Yeah, a number of things spring to mind. Resilience. So, for instance, when I would set certain types of challenging tasks, perhaps more open-ended tasks, particularly for those pupils who more often than not find success in mathematics, you can often find that the willingness to struggle is, it could be a challenge, no pun intended. I think classroom organization in some respects, because the vast majority of pupils, I mean, because you're trying to add in different layers of challenge, and sometimes just the classwork will be challenging for some pupils. But if you're having to create additional content, really dependent on the expectations of the school, sometimes that might be need to be something totally different. Or And perhaps, as it should be, it's almost like a tweak of the question. Like the one I often give, the example I often give is with number bonds. For people who is learning about the number bonds, you might just give a straight bond question. But with the people who you think actually they know these, then I want them to think more carefully about them, more deeply. It might be an open-ended, I've got, here's the total. How many different ways could they be shared out? Whatever, normally sweets, normally, or I mean, I go to socks, but actually socks come in pairs, so that's a totally different mathematical idea we've got going on there. So yeah, so resilience, classroom organization, and then I think a lot of teachers find it difficult sometimes to source inspiration, and because sometimes things will have a label of GD, and that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
All challenges that I've like, or issues rather, around challenges that I've faced myself there that you said, and I got people to sort of speak about ones they've noticed, and I've got this list, and it's not an exhaustive list by any means, but these are sort of some things that I think commonly across our profession, I think people will be able to relate to. So first of all, I guess you touched on it with resilience, so how quickly students disengage with a challenging task. From our standpoint, like, we're only human, and sometimes, like, if we anticipate failure or we see a pupil struggling, that we might sort of over scaffold in the moment or reduce the level of challenge to the point that it's no longer really a challenge for them. Classroom organization, you said, so like things like not giving enough time perhaps, and like being aware that sometimes just giving them more time to struggle with it, and even if they don't necessarily complete it correctly, like giving them enough time to actually wrestle with a challenge. It's also quite difficult to anticipate where learners are, I guess, in a sequence of learning. So, as we said earlier, challenge being relative to the learner, a task you may want to introduce sort of class wide might be challenging for 80% of the class, but it might not be for the other 20%. And then I guess tied to that, it's quite hard to challenge pupils when you don't know them really well. So at the start of the year, it can be quite hard to challenge pupils. And then you mentioned open-ended tasks, and I guess in sort of the inverse of that is that, like, sometimes we might play it really safe and then end up doing very narrow, closed tasks as a result, because we stress about whether pupils will be able to complete them correctly. So yeah, so there's a lot of conditions there, or issues rather, that sort of arise from challenge. I think it's important to consider that learning itself is challenging. If we think about that sort of simple model of memory, Daniel Williams' simple model of memory, the idea of, like, there's information in the environment, we attend to it, it enters into our working memory where it's sort of held, processed, organized, manipulated, and then in the long term, it's stored or encoded into long-term memory, and that information or knowledge can be forgotten from long-term memory or working memory. Well, that process itself is a challenge, isn't it? Like, every day sitting in a classroom, trying to actively attend to things. Learning itself as a process is challenging. So before we even start to go into more depth about it, it's sort of acknowledging that a lot of things need to be in place for challenge to occur. So if an environment can be distracting, we need to limit that. We need to reduce peers distracting one another. We need to think about how we introduce information in chunks. If working memory can get overloaded, then we need to think about how we're going to optimize cognitive load. So are we going to provide it in like a few short steps, a task, or are we going to provide it in sort of a gradual bit by bit sort of approach? If prior knowledge is key and we need people to link to it, then we need to make sure like our retrieval cues are clear, they're explicit. It's easy for people to retrieve that information. So there's a lot of difficulty there in itself, just in the act of sort of teaching and learning, as sort of those sort of concepts. So I guess with that difficulty, it's a great segue here into the idea of desirable difficulties. And for anybody who's not familiar, desirable difficulties are things that sort of create challenge and slow the rate of learning. They sort of slow the rate of learning in sort of the immediate, but actually in the long term, they can optimize long-term retention and transfer. So one of those very counterintuitive findings of education that like we want to sort of present these desirable difficulties to learners, make learning a bit slower, create it more make it more challenging, and that in the long term that actually optimizes how well they can remember something or transfer it across situations. So the idea behind that is not simply to just make learning hard, but to design difficulties into the learning process. So and the reason why they're called desirable difficulties, well, desirable because they optimize that long-term retention, and difficulties because they slow learning down initially. So that's where it's like that counterintuitive idea. And that there's a few desirable difficulties that are very well researched, a very strong evidence base behind them. So first of which is sort of varying the conditions of study and practice rather than keeping them very constant, very predictable, and then regular. The second being interleaving study of like sort of separate topics rather than sort of just grouping topics or blocking them together. The third being spacing practice out over time instead of doing very close together massed sessions on a topic. And I think cognitive science sort of alludes to the idea that the best time to revisit something is around the point when it's just been forgotten. And then the last thing being using testing rather than the sort of repeated presentation of information, sort of reteaching it. So the key idea around those sort of desirable difficulties is that I guess the conditions or strategies that we may use that can very rapidly increase retrieval strength differ from the strategies that actually maximize storage strength. And there being an important difference there. And I saw a great talk. Amarbir Singh Gill, I think his name is. I think he might have a book, but he talked about similar to this, and he talked about how revision as a sort of strategy when pupils are left to do it often fails. And I guess it ties into this idea here that like they're not using strategies for long-term retention. They're using things like highlighting and rereading, things that feel like they increase retrieval strength in the short term. They feel like they're feeling success, they feel like they're getting it right, but actually in the long term they're not maximizing the storage strength of that information. Desirable difficulties, very useful. I definitely advise reading up more on that. I then talked about the idea of sort of encoding storage and retrieval. And I think a prominent issue in recent years, a good issue to have, I guess, is that we've perhaps overemphasized retrieval practice. And in a sense, this is a good thing. It's been for the betterment of our pupils. Education is the best it's ever been. However, a heavy emphasis on retrieval without making sure that the information is encoded into long-term memory in the first time means that retrieval is likely to fall short. So what I sort of posited was that there's been this imbalance in the emphasis between encoding and retrieval. And as a result, it's sort of hindered students' ability to retrieve and apply that knowledge when needed. And like I'm very fortunate in my role to observe a lot of teaching, and it's something that I do observe a lot. And I think Tom Sherrington worded it really well. I saw him at Research Ed Cymru last year, and he said something like, you can't strengthen a path that hasn't been made. And like, I couldn't summarize it better. We need to focus on the encoding of information first before we just jump straight into retrieval. So one way of tackling that is the idea of rehearsal. And I think partner talk is within our curriculum, that's how we build it in. It's a great way to do it. And the idea of saying something like, if you're teaching a child, okay, like the capital city of England is London. Okay, turn to your partner, tell them what the capital city of England is. Just that immediate rehearsal of like, they're just regurgitating that information so you know that they know it. They get the chance to rehearse it in working memory. And that the idea through that rehearsal over time, through sort of partner talk, through teacher questioning, through independent tasks, and so on, that they build that understanding up, and it's more likely to be encoded. And so linked to that idea of sort of jumping into retrieval too early, I then talked about the idea of confusion. So in my reading, that linked me to the idea of productive failure. The research on this, my understanding of the research on this, is that it's quite a mixed bag. The idea that when it's very appropriately implemented, it can lead to sort of better retention of knowledge. It can lead to sort of improved problem solving, increased motivation, and those sort of things. But I'm with Kieran in my skepticism, because I think the effectiveness of it depends on quite a lot, like the nature of the task, the knowledge, the prior knowledge of learners, how good subsequent instruction is, because I guess productive failure or struggle is operating under the assumption that pupils are going to struggle, that they're going to be motivated to keep going, and that they're sort of willing to engage with the instruction afterwards. And some children may disengage through the fact of like they felt failure, because as humans, we don't like to feel failure. So that study I mentioned is an interesting one that I mentioned in a talk by Ashman, Sweller, and Kalyuga, I think they said, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, from 2019. What I found particularly interesting about this study in particular is that it was referring to tasks that had a high element interactivity. So element interactivity is a sort of concept from cognitive load theory. And it essentially means when there's high element interactivity, that there's a sort of a high number of interacting elements to a task. There's more to sort of think about, in other words. So in that sense, it's referring to a very challenging form of task. So in the study, they did two randomized controlled trials with year five pupils. In the first experiment, explicit instruction followed by problem solving was found to be superior to the reverse order for performance on problems that were similar to those used during the instruction. And then there was no sort of real difference when it came to transferring knowledge into different problems. In the second part of the experiment, they increased the element interactivity. So now a more challenging task, more to work with it or consider in working memory. And then explicit instruction followed by problem solving was found to be superior, again, to the reverse order, for performance on both similar problems and on transferring to sort of unfamiliar context. So I guess the takeaway from that is that specifically when learning, when a task is sort of has high element interactivity, explicit instruction should precede problem solving. So I guess it's one of those things that like the jury's kind of out on it a little bit, but the safer bet is, I would argue, is to do instruction first and then present a problem, a difficult task or problem to solve, rather than the other way around. And then, I mean, if I said to you, Kieran, what is the most effective form of pedagogy, what would you say? I'm really putting you on the spot tonight, really making it hard for you.
Have you seen the size of Teach Like a Champion? It's massive. You know, and I tried to, you know, I spent over 300 pages in Thinking Deeply About Paraphrasing, trying to describe. I mean, it's going to take account of all the things you've said, you know, so it's going to involve some sort of direct or explicit instruction, carefully chosen examples, and then supposed to summarize it at like a general phasing from teacher responsibility to pupil responsibility. And in between that, you've got lots of different stages in the back and forth, typically in my classroom, where I'm trying to take on as much information as possible, respond to that information, and then lots of practice. And like you say, spacing out opportunities to revisit that material, you know, certainly, you know, trying to take account of all those phenomena and help it inform what you do in the classroom. But I think it also involves seeing it as a journey that goes on beyond an hour, you know, so it's not just this lesson. Sure, I might be employing some of these strategies on the first time you encounter something, but over time, we're not. So starting to waffle towards the end, but that's sort of where I am in terms of the most effective form of pedagogy. But it's even then, it's hard to say, but it feels like the research is pointing us in this direction.
That is, yeah, that's spot on. So again, I agree with Kieran there. The idea, so I'm a bit of a direct instruction fanboy, shall we say. And I guess you touched on it there, the idea that like when pupils are absolute novices, direct instruction is what they need. And as you alluded to, like the sort of more knowledge they gain over time, that perhaps we can sort of relinquish that a little bit and we can move to more wards like constructivist or problem solving or inquiry based led forms of instruction. So my point there of sort of bringing that up around what is the most effective form of pedagogy is that if linking to what the study I was just talking about, that if explicit instruction should precede problem solving, like what is the most effective form of pedagogy? Well, I then, in my mind, it's direct instruction. If we think about project follow through, the most, as far as I'm aware, I did do some quick Google and I couldn't find anything, the most comprehensive educational study there's ever been. Like circa 200,000 pupils across a 10-year span, number of subjects, the children sort of spanned the full range of sort of characteristics that you'd want in participants, so like socioeconomic background and so on. And they looked at 22 modes of instruction, including direct instruction, and they found that direct instruction outperformed all other modes of instruction in all measures. So that they measured basic academic skills, they measured problem-solving skills, and they measured self-esteem. And direct instruction outperformed all the other modes of instruction in those measures. What's also interesting is that they followed those, some subsequent research followed those children into sort of high school. So I think this study was like 3-year-olds to 12-year-olds, if I'm not mistaken. And subsequent research looked at those pupils and they found that they were more likely to finish high school and also pursue higher education. I thought that was quite an interesting finding that I thought I'd share, because it's not something that that I've seen mentioned many times. So tied into that idea of sort of productive struggle, explicit instruction and confusion. So I looked at the idea of like, is it ever useful to intentionally confuse pupils or sort of contradict them? So, and I came across a few studies. Unfortunately, they were mostly with undergraduate or like university age students. So there was one where sort of they taught people something and then they introduced contradicting information to confuse pupils. And then they found that those pupils who were confused actually showed enhanced performance compared to those who didn't receive confusing material. I think the implication from those who favor this idea of intentionally confusing pupils, this sort of consensus that when students encounter confusion, there's sort of this cognitive conflict and it can act as a trigger to tell them, right, this isn't working, try something else. So then they think about what other strategies can I use? But skepticism again, I mean, that relies on the students being able to identify that like there's this trigger in their mind, like, oh, you need to try something else, rather than them just giving up. And then interestingly, there was a review that looked at sort of intentionally confusing pupils. And it found that with younger students, confusion actually had a negative impact on learning. So in my mind, similarly to sort of productive struggle, productive failure, the jury's out. In the right conditions with the right students, with an expert teacher, yes, it may well work rather effectively, but education's an odds game. We always want to increase those odds as best as possible. We want as safe a chance as possible that people are going to learn. So intentionally confusing them, I think I personally would perhaps avoid. And sort of tied to that, when we think about novices and experts, they're like novices, they've got little background knowledge. They rely very heavily on working memory. When it comes to sort of engaging with a challenging task, they often look at sort of superficial details rather than sort of underlying structures. So they're more likely to experience cognitive lobes. And when we think about that and how novices see and view problems, it sort of becomes immediately clear to me that explicit direct instruction, where it's unambiguous, it's clear, we try to avoid as much as possible confusing pupils, all of that is our best chance to help people on that journey towards becoming more expert. So having more relevant background knowledge, being able to rely on long-term memory rather than working memory, being able to see those underlying structures. Yeah, in my mind, direct explicit instruction is the way to sort of get that vehicle to get us there. And I guess linked to that is the idea that we don't get better at challenging tasks or problem solving by doing more problems. I think Daisy Christodoulou talked about like the idea, this analogy of like, you don't practice for marathons by running loads of marathons, do you? Like, as you said earlier, we build up gradually over time. We gradually remove those scaffolds. And as pupils feel more confident, they're more independent, that's when we start to introduce more challenging work. So tied to that is like, how do we get them to that point? How do we build up to that point? Well, worked examples is one way of, I think, of addressing that. If you're not familiar with worked examples, they are essentially a sort of step-by-step illustration of a process that you need to do to complete a task or solve a problem. And then the idea being that you then give pupils a sort of identical or very similar problem to solve. So the worked example effect, something that's fairly robustly studied, is a part of cognitive load theory. The idea behind it being that you're giving pupils this sort of expert example for them to emulate. As a result, it sort of reduces cognitive load because you've given that example, they just sort of need to follow the steps. It decreases the chances that pupils will get it wrong. And it's a way to sort of gradually remove that scaffold over time as you try to sort of increase more challenge. Perhaps the single most important precondition for challenge is prior knowledge. That's what I alluded to earlier, as sort of Achebel's work alludes to. And the example I gave in the talk is, we have a year six history unit on the Cold War, a unit that's not obviously not normally studied in primary school. And the assessment task at the end of it, pupils have to write an essay. And the essay is, how do historical interpretations of the Cold War differ? I mean, that's sort of question that I was answering at like 15 when I was doing GCSE history. A lot of knowledge that pupils need there, sort of tension between capitalism and communism, understanding of the arms race, how World War II sort of changed the balance of power, and so on. In that essay, we're getting pupils to think about sort of the orthodox and revisionist views of the Cold War. So orthodox historians, they believe that the Cold War began as sort of response to Stalin's sort of expansionism, his aggressive nature, that he was sort of this dictator and we had to stop him to preserve sort of Western freedom and democracy. Whereas the revisionist view sees it as America was pushing its own capitalist agendas on others. So in order for people to sort of answer this quite challenging task, they need to have this very nuanced understanding of empire and why countries or states try to expand. So linking back to the idea of prior knowledge here is how your curriculum over time builds in the ability to build up that prior knowledge. So for example, with ours of empire, they do like Romans in year two. In year three in ancient Greece, they look at Alexander the Great. In year five, they look at the Islamic Empire. In year five, they look at Napoleon, and so on and so on and so on. The idea that over time, they're building this very nuanced understanding of empire that feeds into their understanding of America trying to preserve its status, or Russia perhaps being this aggressive state. And also thinking deeply about how does cross-curricular build in? So within ours, like, we have a year six North America unit where that locational knowledge, they learn about where America is. Obviously, on one side, it's got the Bering Strait very close to Russia. But on the other side, it's got quite a distance between itself and mainland Europe. And that feeds into their understanding of why America would sort of try and have a preservationist stance and why it would try and engage in their sort of European affairs. So prior knowledge being absolutely key. I defined challenge in a simple sentence earlier when I said it's when prior knowledge meets unfamiliar context. Well, if pupils don't have that knowledge, challenge is redundant. There's no point in them trying to engage with it. And so, like, a hard lesson I learned over the years as a novice teacher, trying to introduce very challenging tasks when pupils didn't know the times tables or whatever it may be. Another condition that sort of, I guess, well, I talked there about a precondition leading to like what we need in place to build challenge into learning. But an interesting condition that sort of arises from challenging learning is this idea of stress. Now, I'm not a biologist. I'm not a psychologist. Somebody who is Dan Rosen, who was on a previous episode, which I actually re-listened to recently. And he mentions loads of great papers that I recommend going to read. And I do recommend going back to listen to that episode. Really interesting episode. But one particularly interesting one, I think it was like Vogel and Schwaber. I think it was like a review, a meta-analysis of sorts, I guess, around stress. So, Dan, if you're listening, I'm sorry if I'm going to butcher this, but this is what I took away from both that podcast and that paper. So a few things that sort of stress during learning can actually enhance encoding. So don't panic that a challenging task can sort of present a little bit of stress for pupils because it can perhaps enhance encoding of information. A very interesting takeaway is that stress can impact the act of retrieval. So, I guess perhaps more useful for sort of secondary teachers, the idea that if pupils are really stressed before they go into exams, their cortisol level changes. And as soon as that happens, that stress can impact the act of retrieval from like up to like 90 minutes afterwards. But the biggest takeaway is that retrieval practice can negate the impact of stress. I thought that was fascinating when Dan was sort of talking through that. And the idea that sort of this, how important low stakes retrieval really is, and that it should be used regularly. And so it builds up that memory over time. Again, linked to that idea of sort of explicit instruction and plenty of guided independent practice, you know, Rosenstein's principles that we need a high success rate. And the way to do that is by using things like low stakes retrieval fairly regularly. Because if something is very familiar, then it frees up working memory to think about the actual challenging content, doesn't it, in the moment. So I guess a sort of a brief summary there of all sort of the conditions I touched on. The idea that sort of desirable difficulties are useful, they can support long-term retention and transfer, that don't overemphasize retrieval, focus on encoding first and then move on to retrieval. That instruction before problem solving may be the safer bet than the other way around, or is likely to be the safer bet. That intentionally confusing pupils with older pupils, there is some benefit, but it tends to have a negative impact for younger pupils. And then lastly, that sort of that retrieval practice can help to negate that impact of stress, and that we have to ensure that sort of foundational content is secure to the point of fluency. So be that number bonds, as you mentioned earlier, be that like the phonetic code, be it times tables, the things that children need to use regularly, it just needs to be secure to the point of fluency. So I personally am an advocate of the sort of drill and kill, not to the point that children just sort of regurgitate things like times tables without understanding of them, but to the point that we practice them so much that it becomes second nature. What's that famous phrase? It's something like practice until you remember, or practice until you can't forget. Something that I've butchered it, but something along those lines, isn't it? So practice, practice, practice.
Yeah, I think it's something like it's don't practice until you can do something. It's like practice till you can't not do it. I don't know.
Yeah.
It comes from outside of education, doesn't it?
Yeah, probably. Probably it sounds like a motivational speaker.
Yeah, quite
Is it
possibly.
so it's something like don't practice until you get it right, practice until you can't get it wrong.
There we go. Between us, we were very close.
I quite like that idea that like the idea that something like times tables or phonics, whenever it needs to be retrieved, it can be just done immediately because it's just automatic. And then in doing so, oh, well, I can now do long division or long multiplication with times tables or phonics. I can now read this more challenging book or that I couldn't read before.
Yeah, I mean, if you, times tables are normally useful in situations with high element interactivity. So if you've got those to hand, that's going to make life a whole lot easier for you as a pupil.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, myself as a novice, like I was in year six for years. It took me so long to sort of learn this, but the idea when I'd be teaching pupils long division or long multiplication, I would sort of instruct them how to do it, and then I may use worked examples, or whatever. Then I just set them off independently to have a go at it. And the pupils who didn't have that times tables knowledge, they just struggled because not only did they have to focus on this entirely new method they've never done before. Which is obviously occupying their working memory, but they also had to try and think about times tables at the same time. So the struggle between thinking about both, this led to overload, which meant they disengaged or they didn't necessarily get any questions right. So I eventually realized, like, am I in this task, am I trying to sort of test understanding of times tables knowledge? Not really. So I just gave them the times tables chart. Like, this is what we're working on today. What we're working on today is you learning long multiplication or long division or whatever it may be. And then, as we've talked about, that sort of gradual removal of scaffold. Well, once they've built that sort of process, that procedural knowledge of long division or long multiplication into memory, then I can start to remove the times tables chart that I've given them, because they understand the process. And now I can get them to think about the times tables knowledge as well, because obviously I want them to learn those as well.
Yeah. Although in an ideal world, they would know that those times tables before they get to that.
Yeah, but the reality is that, I mean, every teacher listening will know that that's not the case.
Oh yeah, no doubt. They're probably nodding along as you're saying that. Now, you mentioned your curriculum. How do we sustain challenge over time?
One of the first, as I was reading around sort of trying to sustain challenge, one of the first documents I came across was called Organizing Instruction and Study to Improve Student Learning. It's from the Institute of Education. And it talks about a few, I think it's like seven recommendations in there. And one of them, of which is asking deep explanatory questions. And it has quite a robust evidence base. I think it was something like from 9 years old up to like university age. They've done it in sort of laboratory context, in classroom context. They've done it in science, in history, in maths. And the idea that we sort of use these instructional prompts that encourage students to pose and answer deep level questions. So the first sort of recommendation it gave was around encouraging thinking aloud and providing feedback. So when pupils are giving you answers, asking questions that encourage them to think out loud, to give their thought process out loud. And I think it talked about not only just saying it in speaking, but also using it in writing, getting them to write out their thought process, and then providing feedback based on those thought processes to support pupils in how they think about content. Linked to that, it made a recommendation about asking questions that elicit explanation. So not just questions like how, what, why, but questions like, how does X link to Y? What conclusions can we make about X? Why is X more important than Y? Any sort of question that stimulates deeper processing of the content, deeper thinking, and therefore elicits a sort of a greater explanation from pupils. I think the last recommendation they make is around something around like challenging students' sort of prior beliefs and assumptions. So that might be in science, like where you might draw into misconceptions, or across any subject, I guess you can link to misconceptions. You mentioned curriculum a moment ago, and curriculum, when you've got a sort of well-codified curriculum in place, sort of heavily specified and so on, before you go into your lesson, or you're thinking about planning a lesson in advance, one thing we can think about is what Sullivan et al. Talk about as enabling and extending prompts. So we talked earlier about a potential issue that we may face when we try to implement challenges, that we might over-scaffold in the moment. We see people struggling, we reduce the level of challenge, or we over-scaffold. So they talk about these ideas, or this idea of enabling prompts and extended prompts. So if you've got your curriculum in place, you're looking at your lesson plan, you're thinking, right, this is the challenging task I want to put build into today's learning. An enabling prompt is when you're thinking that when you give that challenging task, you're in advance, you're thinking about when the learner tries to attempt the task, what issues or obstacles might they face? And when they face those, what enabling prompt? So what am I going to say that enables them to then move forward with their learning or to access the task? The idea being that to think about that in depth before the lesson prevents you over scaffolding in the moment. So you think, right, they're doing long multiplication, and that like these are the sort of steps they're going to have to do. What might they struggle with? Well, I'm going to give them that enabling prompt, like, oh, don't forget to use your times tables chart, or whatever it may be, rather than just going like, oh, well, you do this, you do this, you do this, and you're doing the steps for them. The inverse of that being the sort of extending prompt. So these are prompts that you want to extend the thinking of a learner. So let's say they sort of rather quickly complete the task, or they can access it rather easily. It's not particularly challenging for them as you may have intended. And the idea, rather than sort of creating a new task in the moment that may not meet sort of the same context or instructional intentions, that you have this extending prompt that's designed to extend their thinking on that same task and that same context, rather than sort of creating some challenge in an entirely separate context altogether. Again, so having that in advance can prevent us from going like what I used to do, like, oh, we've done 5-digit numbers, let's now just add 6-digit numbers. If I thought about in advance, like, right, what I'm trying to get into do here is sort of column addition, place value, I might have thought about something like, okay, as a challenge, I'm going to remove some digits and have like blank boxes. I'm going to have some transfer. So now they need to think about, oh, what would add to that to transfer into the next column, that sort of stuff. And another thing linked to that idea of like us not over scaffolding, came across this study called Children Persist Less When Adults Take Over. So in the study, it looked at, I think it was like 4 to 8 year olds. So perhaps not necessarily replicable with older pupils. And it involved parents in part of it. But so in the first part, there's sort of this observational study, and they found that parents who took over more during this challenging puzzle task that children were given, those parents were more likely to rate their children as sort of being less persistent. So the researchers, they saw that from that study, and they looked to sort of investigate it further to establish whether taking over can sort of reduce persistence of pupils. So in like the next experiment, they had 150 pupils, sort of 4 and 5 years old in the second experiment. And then they found that children assigned to the sort of taking over condition persisted less on a subsequent task compared to those who didn't have adults trying to take over. And it didn't matter if they reframed the context, it didn't stop that negative impact of an adult taking over. So something I need to read around more myself, but I guess the implication there being that taking over a lot actually impairs the child's ability to persist or be resilient, as you sort of touched on earlier. In primary, obviously, we're often very fortunate to have a teaching assistant in the room. So I looked at an additional adult, and I thought, well, let's have a look into the sort of impact of those adults and around this sort of idea of persistence. I came across this interesting study from a while ago. I think it was called the Deployment and Impact of Support Staff. It's DISS for short, DISS project, like DISS. A huge study. It was like 8,000 pupils. I think it was English, math, science. And there were like two cohorts of pupils in 7 age groups. And they're all in sort of mainstream schools, tracked over a single year. So quite a fairly expansive study, not quite project follow through, but significant numbers compared to sort of the average study you come across. And interestingly, they found that in 16 of the 21 results, there was a negative direction, and that there were no positive effects of teacher assistant support for any subject or any year group. Now, is that to say teaching assistants are useless and they don't have positive effect? Of course not. Of course not. Of course, I'm not saying that. But the implication there is like, how do we make the best use of teaching assistants? And I mean, everybody knows adults in the classroom are the most important and valuable resource that we have. Well, in the one useful sort of resource to guide and support your teaching assistants in how to support pupils in the moment, I forget what it's called. I should have read all these up. They've got a report around teaching assistants. It might be called like making the best use of teaching assistants, something like that, maximizing impact. And in it, they have this sort of pyramid model of support. And it's like on one side going up, it's like teaching assistant support. And on the other side, it's like pupil independence, and it's sort of how the two correlate. So, for example, it might start with like the teaching assistant just corrects the pupil in the moment. That is heavily scaffolded. There's no independent thinking on the part of the learner. Of course, like occasionally it's useful to do, but that's not getting the learner to think. So then it has these stages, like the next stage being like modeling, that the TA will sort of model the steps that a pupil needs to complete, and then they then go on and complete it. Cluing, so a TA might use a statement like, this ruler will help you, or how could the ruler help you? So they give them a clue as like what they need to use, but not over scaffolding. Then there's the idea of prompting. So a TA may say something like, can you remember what Mr. Mackle said you have to do first, what he said you have to do at this next step? So you're prompting them to think. And then right up to the point that, like, when it was self-scaffolding, so observing a people, seeing that they can do it independently, and then you don't need to intervene at all. So you're seeing that they can access that work, and you're letting them get on with it. You're sort of overseeing it from a distance, but you're letting them get on with it. So I should just stress and emphasize there, I think teaching assistants are great. I'm not trying to try to use that study to denounce all teaching assistants. I've worked with some absolutely incredible teaching assistants over the years. I guess the idea being that teaching assistants, same as teachers, we're all human. We want pupils to learn. And our natural response is that if we see a child struggling, we want to support them. And that in the moment, that can lead to us over scaffolding, reducing the level of challenge. So we're thinking about how can we support the pupil without those things happening, without over scaffolding, without reducing that level of challenge. I think a big thing about sustaining challenge over time is that pupils need to feel success. They need quick, easy wins. So nice, easy questions that build confidence, build competence, so that every learner feels like they're successful. Because if you want them to attempt a challenging task and all of their prior experience with tasks is, well, I always struggle, I find it hard, I don't understand, then they're not going to engage in future tasks. I think Peps McRae talks about it as the idea of like expectancy and cost. In Motivated Teaching, great book, really recommend reading that. And the interesting thing around sort of success and motivation, I think there's been like research into like which one drives the other, and it's actually sort of a bi-directional reciprocal relationship, that like success drives motivation and motivation drives success, this cyclical thing. And if we want pupils to feel successful, then we need to give them very easy tasks, quick wins. And that will build their motivation to attempt slightly harder tasks in the future. And that we need to give them those quick wins over time. I guess that's it in a nutshell of like how we sustain challenge, or things that I've read around a sustaining challenge. So asking those deep explanatory questions that get pupils to think more deeply about content. So like, how is X linked to Y? Thinking in advance, looking at your curriculum, at your lesson plans, what enabling prompts and extending prompts am I going to use so that I don't over scaffold in the moment? Being conscious that when adults take over a lot, that perhaps children persist less in the long run, and thinking about how all adults in the classroom are aware what sort of level of support or scaffold needs to be in place at certain points in time to ensure that that child's learning. And then success and motivation drive one another. We want people to feel motivated to attempt challenging tasks. They need to feel quick wins. They need to feel successful. So ties in well with that drill and kill I said around like times tables and follics things. These things that we need to be fluent, automatic with, we need to make sure that pupils not only practice them a lot, but they feel like quick, easy wins with it. So in those times tables tests, that they're getting questions right and so on.
Nice. I love how you're taken back. Drill and kill, you know, people use it as a disparaging term, but actually no, you're fully embracing it, you're taking it back. My big takeaway is that you've outlined lots of things that teachers and school leaders should now think about, you know, if they weren't already. Okay, if you want to make sure pupils are adequately challenged, here are the places you can spend your attention getting to know more about, like you say, because the amount of the idea of confusion feels like one of those ones, you know, it might work, but there are other things that are more likely to work. And I think that's key. And so, but everything you've said, I think, comes back to school leaders almost having this picture. You know, you asked me what the most effective form of pedagogy is. I think there's a case to be made for taking what you've said tonight as an influence for the pedagogical model you do choose, you know, and it won't be an exact replica of everything you said, but I think there's a lot of inspiration, and you can see why people have made other decisions based on what we know about what makes things difficult for pupils. So I think it's going to be massively useful. Just Cambridge you're doing coming up? So that was going to be one of my questions. Do you have any other research heads?
Just Cambridge currently. Unfortunately, for my sins, I'm a Gillingham fan. I'm a Gillingham season ticket holder. We are flirting with the playoffs at the moment, and a lot of research ed events fall on Saturdays, or they all do, as do Gillingham home games. So I'm sort of trying to go to events that are on alternating Saturdays. And Cambridge is one of those. I think it's during, it might even be during a half term for me. I can't remember. But yeah, I would love to go to more. I think I'll likely apply for the national one in September. I've missed that the last couple years because of weddings. So I'd love to go to that, and I'll probably refine this talk over time and hopefully do that at Research Ed National.
Nice. I mean, if you're in the playoff final, I'll be there. You know what I mean? I went up to 2009.
Yeah, as did I. Good
I
times.
had money on nil-nil and for both teams to win on penalties. And I'm almost certain you scored in the 97th minute or something like that there.
Yeah, it was very late on. And it was also rather infamously not a corner. We had a corner and then the smallest man on the pitch headed a goal in, but it wasn't a corner. It shouldn't have been a corner. So we were very fortunate there. And Shrewsbury hit the bar.
Yeah,
So.
I was raging because I could have had a lot of money that day. But I was in with all the Gills fans, so.
Yeah,
Quite good
still a
time.
win. Yeah.
Yeah, fingers crossed, fingers crossed. Yeah, what have I got? I've got Southwest coming up on the 27th, which is the week after. And I can't really push my luck and go for, because it's on the 20th of April, Cambridge, as far as I'm aware. So it sounds like it's going to be really
Yeah.
good. But I can't push my luck because I've got Birmingham this weekend. And in fact, people might be on their way back or to Burnham. Say hello to everybody on their way back. Yeah. So yeah, I really appreciate you going through this with us. I think it'd be really interesting to go follow up in a year's time when you've had more time to look inside those nooks and crannies of some of the sort of lesser research, but or lesser discussed elements of the research. But all I said to do is say thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.
Da 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 da.